Hey, Almighty Ballin listeners, I am back with my co-host Michael Luxenberg on another edition of Unguarded Shooting, and we're here to talk hoops for the day of November 15th, the year of our Lord. Every year is the year of our Lord. We're about to talk about some NBA games, and it's going to be exciting, and we're going to break them down and get in depth and have some valuable knowledge about basketball, about hoops for you to learn. But before that, quick message from Michael Luxenberg, my co-host, at MLSurfboard on Twitter. Go ahead and follow him on our sponsor for today.
Yeah, so this episode of the Unguarded Shooting Podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Reading is hard, not just the sounding stuff out, but finding the dang time. Save yourself the hassle, go to audibletrial.com/almighty after you listen to us, and get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial. Audible has over 180,000 titles for your iPhone, Android, and other similar devices. Me, I can't stop reading Brent Weeks' Lightbringer novels. I don't even know for sure if they're good, but I really have to know what happens. So you know how I've worked my mainlining several 600-page novels into my life? Audible. I get my fix when I walk the dog, the rare times that I exercise, or the frequent times I ride the bus. And you can do the same. Just head over to audibletrial.com/almighty and get your free audiobook today.
Yeah.
Thanks, Audible.
Go do that. And by doing so, you get a great product, which is Audible, which is great. Again, audibletrial.com/almighty. And it is completely free, right? And you support the network and what we're doing here at almightyballer.com and the Almighty Baller Podcast Network. And I cannot thank you enough. Again, whenever you use one of our promo codes or whenever you go to audibletrial.com/almighty, right, and get a free trial, you are supporting the network. You're keeping us safe and warm from the wolves outside of our studio who want to eat us. But if you buy, from SteinerSports.com, our other sponsor for today, or when you go to audibletrial.com/almighty, you're supporting us and keeping us safe, and I cannot appreciate it more. So, anyways, the main games that we're breaking down tonight are the Toronto Raptors and Cleveland first, and then we're going to move into Charlotte and Minnesota, and then last, we're going to wrap it up with Chicago and Portland. But there was also Atlanta Hawks 93, Miami 90, and Brooklyn lost to the Lakers 125-118.
So as far as Hawks Heat goes, the Hawks were missing Dwight Howard after the third quarter. The Heat were missing Winslow and Goran Dragic, so there's not a lot to take away from this game other than a hobbled Hawks team is slightly better than a hobbled Heat team. At the same time, in the Lakers-Nets game, the big takeaway is the young guns. Russell scored 32. Julius Randle had himself a triple-double. They're playing hard. They're playing fast for Walton. But, I don't think we're going to get a real test of whether or not they're really a 7-5 team until we see them play something a little stronger competition. So it's probably just worth it to dive right into the big games for the night.
Right, exactly. So the first game of the night that we're going to discuss in depth is the Toronto Raptors versus the Cavaliers. This one was in Cleveland, and they won by 4 points. It was 121-117. So before getting more in depth into what exactly happened, what were your main takeaways from the game?
A few. I mean, I think we saw that, the Raptors can play with the Cavaliers, right? Like, they play hard, they execute. They find ways to get extra possessions, whether that's through rebounds or turnovers. And they do a good job of sort of taking advantage of those moments. But also was pretty clear that the Cavaliers have a couple of lineups that pose huge problems for Toronto defensively. That kind of swung the outcome of that game, I think.
Yeah, I think the main ones were, and we talked about this going into this game, the main lineups that I think the Cavaliers had difficulties with.
Or the Raptors had difficulties with?
Oh, yeah, right. That the Raptors had difficulties with was either the ones with Kevin Love at the center, which we saw a lot of with RJ playing power forward, or just any time that Channing Frye was playing center. And, I mean, the Raptors are hardly alone in the fact that they're going to have difficulty with that. But I think particularly, Bea Nguera has not played a lot of NBA minutes. He doesn't really know how to deal with, trying to be a rim protector when at the same time trying to chase guys out to the three-point line. And then Valanciunas has never been a defensive stud, but particularly when sort of roped out of his element by big men who can stretch the floor, yeah, that's a problem.
He's just not quick enough to play on the perimeter, really. He's like a pretty lumbering dude.
Right, and then to make matters even worse, their other big who could have potentially played center, and I think that if they do match up in the playoffs, Coach Casey will at least try this. Who's their the rookie, the guy starting at power forward?
Siakam?
Yeah, Pascal Siakam is a rookie. You know?
Yeah.
And he's been impressive, and he's been, you know, particularly impressive for a rookie, and he's been great at defense, but, I mean, asking him to play center against, like, a team full of big guys who are fast and, you know, basically asking him to play center against, like, the NBA champions is perhaps asking too much. So, yeah, I just think that the Toronto Raptors really never answered the what are we going to do if there's a stretch five, but, like, it's not like very many teams can answer that question anyways.
Right, and they got pretty dang close towards the end. Like, Lowry played really well in the fourth quarter. DeRozan shot under his average. I think that it's like when he shoots around 40 or like less than 45 or something, they've lost every game this season when that happens.
Yeah, which is not happening very much. DeRozan going into the game was averaging like 35 points a game on, you know, 60% shooting or something ridiculous like that.
And, yeah, like 55 or something like that.
Yeah, he's outrageous. Hitting particularly ridiculous numbers, or percentages rather, from, you know, like 16 feet to the 3-point line, and then, you know, from mid-range to just places where NBA players generally don't hit 60% of their shots. They generally hit 40% of their shots. So, yeah, he fell back down to earth. Actually, he fell a little bit closer to what his career averages have been after being incredibly hot to start out the season. So, I mean, one thing we actually brought up is, like, if DeRozan had hit those shots, they would have won. I mean, this was a really close game.
Right, like, yeah, if he had hit his average, that would have been, or his percentages, that would have been probably about the difference. And, yeah, I mean, and that being said, you know, Terrence Ross had a real good game, and you're not going to get that every time against the Cavaliers, you know. So it's hard to say that, like, if DeRozan had shot better, they would have won, because in a world where DeRozan shoots better, maybe Ross doesn't shoot as well, or rather, you know, in this particular game maybe. But as far as, like, projecting this matchup forward, like, they got some unexpected contributions to make up for some sort of fall off from where they expected points to come from. But at the same time, that still wasn't enough to sort of overcome what the Cavs were doing in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, and one of those contributions was actually Kyle Lowry, who had a much better game. He had been struggling a lot during the start of the season, and that's partially why DeMar DeRozan had to make up for so much scoring load. Although he was doing it super well, you know, the only reason, I mean, of course they would have won if DeMar DeRozan had been able to keep up his ridiculous averages that he had been having over the course of the season. But the fact that Kyle Lowry was a lot better than he had been up to this point was significant.
Yeah, particularly in the fourth quarter.
Right, right. Kyle Lowry went 11 for 23, including 4 for 8 from three-point land. And a lot of his three-pointers were not easy three-pointers, that he was, like, falling to the side with a couple of seconds.
I remember that
left.
that one leaner at the end of the shot clock around the screen that was outrageous.
And he also got to add on to those 28 points off of 11 shots. He had 9 assists, 4 steals, which was definitely great, and 5 rebounds, too. So he was plus 8 on the game, and then DeMar DeRozan was minus 9, and that's a little bit more like the Raptors of old.
Yeah, it definitely, you know, it definitely solidified in my mind that there's not much any team in the East can really do against the Cavs in, like, over the course of 7 games. Like, you see the Raptors playing like this, and you can totally see where they steal a game or two, maybe even 3, but the idea of them winning a 7-game series against this Cavs team, given the way their 2 matchups this season have gone, seems pretty unlikely. Like, the first game they lost by 3 in Toronto, despite an overwhelming rebounding advantage. This game they lost by 4 in Cleveland, despite a pretty overwhelming turnovers advantage.
Yeah. And they got pretty soundly beat on the boards this game.
Yeah.
Toronto had, or I guess they, the Cavaliers had 46 team rebounds and the Raptors had 40. So I guess in the fourth quarter, the Cavaliers made up for, the Raptors had a lot of really key offensive rebounds and a lot of really good rebounds. But I mean, part of that was because the most of the fourth quarter, Channing Frye was playing at center, and like you give up some rebounding having Channing Frye in the game instead of Tristan Thompson, but you also have Channing Frye hitting threes over and over and over. I felt like Channing Frye at the end of the game had like three dagger threes.
Yeah, and I also thought Tyronn Lue actually coached a pretty impressive fourth quarter. Had a couple of good out of timeout calls, like play calls.
I was going to talk about the one that sort of put the nail in the coffin to put the Cavs up by five with like
the
30 seconds left.
The back screen from Kyrie that LeBron looped around and got the pass from Kevin Love.
Yeah, so basically what happened is it was an inbound play call by Tyronn Lue. They passed the ball to LeBron at the top of the key, who then passed it to Kevin Love, who was up at the top of the three-point line. And then LeBron curled behind Kyrie, who was setting a pick, and you know, swung around the back, drove baseline, and caught a pass from Kevin Love, and then had a really great finish, reverse layup. It was a layup, not like a dunk. He did earlier in the game have a pretty sweet looking reverse dunk. But the reason why I thought this play was particularly cool was because, and the reason why I think it was such a great play by Lue is A, it was a great play, but B, it really put on display the three maybe most defining aspects of those three players. So what I mean is Kevin Love is really starting to fit into this Cavaliers team more, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that he's getting some of the assists that he used to have when he was on the Timberwolves. He used to average like five assists a game.
Yeah, he's doing a lot more high post, like pivot for the offense kind of stuff.
Yeah, and like Kevin Love was the guy who set up LeBron on their dime here, right? And then it also put, I think, Kyrie's maybe number one asset besides his actual scoring, but just his gravity, the threat of Kyrie to score is what made the communication on a potential switch, like whoever was defending LeBron, the guy who's defending LeBron and the guy who's playing Kyrie, right? Communicating on that switch is so hard to do because the Raptors knew that if you give any space to Kyrie, he's going to kill you. And so, like, that gave LeBron just that little bit of separation to get open for the pass from Kevin Love because it was so hard to communicate on that switch, or do I go over, do I go under, like, can I give LeBron a little bit of space if I don't, you know, and I decide that I'm going to stay on Kyrie, is LeBron just going to get open for the layup? And yeah, that's what happened.
I mean, we've seen this a little bit this season, and I think you're spot on. Like, the fact that Kyrie and LeBron sort of function as simultaneous decoys for each other on any given play, that like you're forced to worry about both of them and you sort of have no idea which is sort of the target of the inbounds play, has really made the Cavs inbound possessions like just exceedingly dangerous.
It's made like every possession really.
Right, but it makes them able to run these like really good out of timeout plays because they're able to like really mess with like the defense's, like you're saying, defense communication, their ability to like know their assignments, because they had to constantly be in fear that like not only is it a fear that like LeBron or Kyrie could be the primary threat, but like on that play, like a Kevin Love sort of turnaround from that position and like posting up in the high post like isn't out of the question and is not like a terrible shot.
Well, he could have had just a straight, I think he was up at the 3-point line.
He was he was somewhere between the curve of the bucket and the 3-point line, I think. But yeah, he was in that neighborhood.
Yeah, if both players hadn't gotten open, right, off of that play, and Kevin Love just needed to shoot a spot up three, he could have done that, and it would have been a good shot for the Cavs.
Right, that's what I'm saying. And then that means that his defender has to hang on him, and then you have the two defenders who are forced to choose between Kyrie and LeBron. You have two other defenders guarding the other guys. All of a sudden, there's like no help on those back cuts, and that's how LeBron was so open for that finish. Like it's hugely advantageous, and that's just part of how I think Tyronn Lue coached this game pretty impressively in the fourth quarter, because he also made some really good personnel changes. The last big Raptors offensive possession, he took out Channing Tatum.
Or Channing Frye.
Channing Frye. He took... Oh, yeah, I'd take out Channing Tatum. He took out Channing Frye, and he took out whoever was playing on the wing and put in Shumpert and Thompson.
Which was the move.
Yeah, which was the move, and it paid off huge because Thompson got a really tough defensive rebound and Shumpert played really great defense in that possession. And just, like, those little things make a huge difference in these, like, 4 or 5 point games between elite teams, and it just sort of showed that, like, there's definitely a talent gap between the two, and the execution and the sort of intellect that Tyronn Lue is displaying is just going to make that much more difficult to overcome.
Yeah, it's also worth mentioning that the Cavaliers started Richard Jefferson because J.R. Smith was out. He was in street clothes. He looked pretty cool. He was wearing, like, a blazer because I think that that's... There's like a dress code and stuff, right?
Yeah, you have to wear a suit.
He looked really suave. I think he had like a cream blazer and like a navy, like...
I think he had a dark jacket and a light shirt.
I'm going to look
it up. If I remember correctly.
Actually, I'm not going to look it up. It'd be too hard to find out.
But he looked good as the...
He looked great. I mean, it's JR. You don't need me to tell you that JR looks great. You know that JR looked great and it was great. But it is interesting to think whether or not the Raptors... would have not been as close the entire game if J.R. Smith had been there, which is a distinct possibility because, I mean, I think a lot of the plays that, you know, Kyrie was able to, you know, get break free for a rebound, there were a lot of good offensive rebounds. A lot of the little stuff that the Raptors got on the Cavaliers, and there was a lot, just like 50-50 balls, offensive rebounds. I mean, a lot of that had to do with the fact that Richard Jefferson was there, and if you're 37 or 36 or however old he is,
612.
Yeah, you shouldn't, like, be throwing yourself on the ground. So, like, they were clearly missing a scrappy type of player, right? You know, who isn't, like, a superstar. And then Iman Shumpert, when he was in the game, he was doing some of that, and he was good on defense, but he looked more like Iman Shumpert last year than what Iman Shumpert had been for the first few games of the season. Iman Shumpert shot 1 for 5 for this game, and he was missing a lot of wide-open corner threes. And he had been a lot better up to this point in the season, but he was not particularly excellent this
game. Yeah. But if I'm a Raptors fan, I think there are a couple of things in this game that you can take away and feel pretty good about.
Terrence Ross.
Yeah, we talked about Terrence Ross hit some big shots. Talked about how Kyle Lowry really kind of broke out of a funk. Jonas Valanciunas, I thought, had some really good stretches in this game as well. Looked pretty hard for the Cavs to guard and was getting a lot of good doing some good rebounding work, and even playing some pretty strong defense in the post. And it looked like they were doing a good job of getting in the ball and making things happen with him. And also, like, Siakam, I thought, was, you know, not like a revelation or anything, but, like, he was beating the Cavs down the floor for buckets.
Yeah.
He was rolling hard to the rim. He was playing strong defense. Norm Powell, I thought, looked really good as well. And so I think there's some good takeaways, and there's some things where, like, you could see if Siakam develops a little bit, if Powell develops a little bit, if they figure out how to get Valanciunas in the flow of the offense, if DeRozan can stay close to what he's been, if Lowry can continue to play at a high level, you can see this team challenging the Cavaliers, in theory. It's just, like, that's a lot of ifs.
Yeah, well, I think there are some crucial mismatches. We talked a little bit, I think, before we started recording about Pascal Siakam and what it means to the Raptors that he's starting at power forward and that he's way better than people thought he was going to be. He's 22, so he's a little bit of an older rookie, but he was still the 27th pick in the first round. It's rare for a rookie to step in and be as good as he's been, especially defensively, so far this season. But we talked about the possibility of maybe playing Pascal Siakam a little bit at center. But, like, for a 6'9 power forward playing out of position against the NBA champion in a potential playoff rematch, that's hard. And, like, So if you want to say, okay, well, Solinger is going to be back and playing power forward, oh boy.
Yeah, I don't know how much of an upgrade Solinger is on what Siakam's giving them, really.
Well, but in the specific problem that I think the Raptors are going to have with the Cavs, he's a downgrade, right? I mean, if you're going to have him, if you're going to have Solinger and Valanciunas, right, as your big men trying to get out on Kevin Love and Channing Frye and LeBron when he's playing the four, you're going to get slaughtered.
Yeah, I think that's just about right. Yeah. Like, yeah, they don't have a lot of big men who can run around to the perimeter, and that's definitely, going to be a pretty major problem for them going forward. I mean, not always, but at least against teams like the Cavaliers.
Against elite competition.
Yeah, against high-level competition, that's going to be a huge problem for them going forward. Even the Hornets gave them trouble when we watched that Hornets game. Like, Kaminsky was a problem for them at stretches.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's not, like, the fastest or best version of that player, but even that was an issue for them.
Right. Although I do think he is the fastest and the best version, so... just kidding. He's not that great. I forgot what the last thing I was going to say was. I guess we can move on, because I just don't remember what I was going to say.
Sure.
So the next game we watched was... The next game we watched was the Wolves versus the Hornets. The Wolves won this one. Oh, wait. Just kidding. They lost 115 to 108. The Hornets won, and it was a story of third quarters.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's actually crazy. This game, the first half, they were up 12 going to halftime. They played really well. They were playing good offense. They were even playing some pretty solid defense. I mean, Charlotte's not like an offensive juggernaut, but they were keeping them in check pretty well in the first half.
It was 58-46 going into halftime.
Yeah, which is, that's fine. Like,
yeah.
I'll take all those numbers. But then, you know, in sort of what's becoming increasingly traditional for the Wolves, like, the third quarter was just like an absolute butt storm.
Yeah.
Like, they were outscored by like 20 in the third.
Let's see.
Maybe 19?
I think it was 7. Yeah, it was 19 points. The Wolves had 17 points in the third quarter, and the Hornets had a compelling 36 points. So, yeah, 19-point differential.
Yeah, and you see, it was, you know... I mean, the offense obviously wasn't good. 17's not particularly impressive. But their defense was just like... It was a tragedy tonight. Like, they couldn't get any kind of thing going on the defensive end in the third quarter in particular, but in the second half in general. They, like, couldn't really stop the Hornets at all.
And Thibodeau continues to look just utterly disgusted by them. It's weird. I mean, in a sense... I mean, everyone agrees that the Wolves have so much promise, and in certain ways, they have even more promise than we thought, because Wiggins is... everyone was clearly convinced that Karl-Anthony Towns was going to be a superstar, but Wiggins is increasingly looking like a co-superstar, right? Especially offensively. LaVine looks great on offense. It's like... The fact that they are second in the league in offense right now makes the Wolves even more promising, but the fact that they're still so bad at defense and they can't finish these games, especially in the third quarter, it's, you know, I think this was like their 10th game. I'll look up their record here really fast.
They're 3-7.
So the fact that they're now 3-7, it's like, they're one of the youngest teams in the league, if not the youngest. I think that they're probably not the youngest, but...
I think they're second only to Phoenix.
Yeah, so the fact that they're the second youngest team in the league, it's like, you got to give them leeway, but what I was saying with Steve McPherson was, if this team is going to be so amazing, if this is going to be like the championship contender team that we thought... And specifically, if Karl-Anthony Towns is going to be a defining big man of this generation, then they shouldn't be this bad defensively.
Well, and that's the thing is you're seeing... This is what makes it so frustrating and confusing, right? Is that it's not even like the one-on-one defense is that bad.
Yeah, when you watch them, team-wide collapses.
It's the second rotation. It's not like the help guy will get there on time, then no one slides to cover the help guy's man. Like, it's team-wide issues, it's rotation issues, but it's increasingly frustrating because you see on almost every possession that these dudes can all play defense.
Well, and
at a pretty high level. But they just can't seem to execute the team concept at all in the third quarter.
And, you know, there were a lot of plays where Gorgui Dieng showed us why so many people were unconvinced by him going into the season, right? I mean, Gorgui Dieng, you know, has always been like a pretty good jump shooter. He's always been a good shot blocker. But still, so many Wolves fans, still they lost a ton of games, right? And he never had a particularly great effect on his team in terms of like box score plus minus. And he defensively looked pretty bad given some advanced statistics. And we saw a whole lot of that because, you know, we watched that one play with the power forward
with
guy.
With Bielitsa?
Yeah, with Bielitsa, where he assumed that Bielitsa knew that a guy was coming up to set a screen on him and didn't call it out, didn't say, like, hey, Bielitsa, you're going to run into someone. And, like, you remarked that it looked like Bielitsa looked right at him. So I understand why he made that assumption, but Joakim Noah would not have made that assumption.
Right, and then even there, and the second level of that is, like, if he saw there's a man coming to the screen, he should have at least, like, stepped out to the dude who was then made open by that. Like,
right.
He didn't react to the screen happening, and then there was a wide-open three.
I'm not even sure if he put up his hands.
He didn't.
So, yeah, I mean, Gorgui Dieng just, like, he has a really low basketball IQ, as far as I can tell. You know, really soft touch offensively. It's hard for jump shooters, especially jump shooting big men, to tell what their offensive IQ is. So I just don't know. But, like, I can more than speculate. I can observe that his defensive IQ is low, and the fact that he doesn't communicate makes that all the much worse.
Well, his offense, yeah, I tend to agree. Like, his offense, I think he does a really good job of getting to spots to put himself at advantage and to get his shots and to mess with the defense. I think he actually does a very good job of that on offense. But on defense, it's just like he's just not reacting. Like, you know, the defense is supposed to be on a string, and it just seems like he's floating off on his own in space.
Yeah, yeah. And like, of course, you can't ask Gorgui Dieng or any player to make up for every team's mistake, but it's still, do you want to say, okay, if your offense is great, right, then, you know, maybe it's not such a big problem that Ricky Rubio can't shoot really well, because if he's making a top two offense tick, then that's fine. And then point guard defense, you know, Ricky Rubio's a great defender. So, like, all's fine and well at the point guard position. And then, like, you're not going to move on from Zach LaVine or Wiggins or Towns, because they all are great and good. And though Zach LaVine has some issues with communication and with defense and stopping his man one-on-one, like, whatever. Like, I can't help but feel like the glaring question for the Timberwolves at this point is the center position, because the center position defines, really, I think ultimately at the end of the day, how good is your defense going to be. And, like,
well, I mean, we saw, like, a glaring example of sort of the problem of Gorgui Dieng, right? Not just the Bielitsa play, but there was a play where Dieng had been guarding Kaminsky, and he got switched off of him, so that Rubio was guarding Kaminsky, and he didn't sag back in or make the switch back easy, and then Kaminsky just, like, exerted 40 pounds and 6 inches on Ricky Rubio and got an and-one. Like, it was the sort of thing where, like, these are, you know, obviously, You can't expect a young team to make the right play every time, but it really kind of felt like they were making the wrong play every time.
Well, so here's a little bit more to that point, a little bit more hate for Dieng statistically. Cody Zeller had a plus 25 line, right?
Well, Cody Zeller actually played a heck of a game.
But why? Because Gorgui Dieng, like, wasn't doing it right, you know?
Well, in part, but he also was setting, like, really phenomenal screens. He was finishing effectively, and he was playing good defense. Like, Curry Zeller's had himself a game.
Yeah, but like, I'm saying that, like, so much, when the person playing opposite of you looks great, like, especially when it's a guy like Cody Zeller and not a guy like LeBron who, like, will make something work even when there's nothing to make it work, right? When Cody Zeller looks really good against you, like, that means that you did something wrong. Because, like, ultimately, like, yes, he had a good game, but he was taking advantage of things that were there that should not have been there.
I think to some extent. I think that, like, his screen setting, like I said, was really phenomenal. That, I think, would have been true regardless of Gordy Dang or not.
But if your center setting screens is consistently effective, like, then your center defending those screens is not doing a great job. And I was going to go on to the only... there were two positive plus-minus guys coming off the Hornets bench. Marco Bellinelli with a plus one. And then Kaminsky, like you were saying, Kaminsky had the game of his... I'm not going to say career, but certainly of the season thus far, with 20 points and then 3 of 7 from 3. Yeah. So,
like, no, I mean, Kaminsky's the best... Like, I think that Zeller was doing so much off-ball stuff that it's not necessarily fair to put all of that on Dang, but I think Kaminsky's the better argument for what you're saying. That, like, Kaminsky's performance is like, Gordy, what the heck are you doing?
Yeah, and I get what you're saying, but, like, I still am going to say that you know, if that had been... I don't know. If that had been Dwight Howard, honestly, like, Cody Zeller setting good screens would not have mattered. Like, you know? I mean, it's like...
Yeah, I just don't think... I think that in the Thibodeau defense, right, the big man's hang back a little bit, and so the screen wasn't keeping Gorgui off the ball. It was keeping, like, Rubio and Ish off the ball.
Well, but, like, Gorgui couldn't compensate for anyone's mistakes, though. And, like, that's important. He, like, wasn't contesting drives well. He wasn't doing a good job on deciding when you want to show and when you don't, because there were plenty. I mean, Nick Batum was hitting so many threes off of
Cody Zeller screens.
Right. Well, just off of any screens, but
they're mostly Cody Zeller screens. That he was all
right. 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 Where like Gorgui could have at least gotten a hand in his face, and like a good defensive center would have at least gotten a hand in his face. It's just you know. Regardless of whether we want to pin it all on Gorgui, which I think neither of us want to, although it sounds like I'm blaming it all
right,
on Gorgui.
Right, because I mean, we saw errors from everyone. We saw, like, Wiggins miss rotations. We saw Towns miss rotations. We saw Rubio fall into bad one-on-one matchups. We saw Zach LaVine get cooked. Like, it wasn't just Dang, but Dang's issue is, like, the most glaring version of the issue that they're all kind of having.
Yeah, because center help defense is the most vital form of help defense, right?
Yeah.
And, like, center defensive communication is the most vital form. Rudy Gobert, right? If Rudy Gobert was on the Timberwolves, this team would not be 24th in the league. They would have won this game, first of all.
Yeah.
But, like, they would be just replacing Gorgui Dang with someone who was more vocal, more aggressive, more instinctual, and just better at big man defense, like, that would make them, I think, a top half of the league in terms of defense, because, you know, you already have, like, a really good point guard in Karl-Anthony Towns. You know, he's a sophomore, and he still makes, you know, young guy mistakes, like, rookie mistakes, although he's not a rookie, but, like, he's a good defender. And Wiggins... The problem with Wiggins is, like, I just don't think he's a great team defender, and what I've said that they should do is just use him as a lockdown guy and, like, stop asking him to, like, do a whole bunch of rotation-type stuff.
But I do think he's getting better at it, though. Like, I mean...
He didn't look better tonight.
Yeah, I thought he was doing a pretty okay job of making his rotations. He was doing a bad job of making sure that there was, like... I think that when he left his man, there was someone coming to cover for him.
Yeah.
He was, like, leaving his man early and stuff. But yeah, I think he was making pretty solid reads, which was an issue earlier in his career. So I do think he's improving in that respect. But yeah, like, it's just everything with that defense. And, like, it might... I mean, I don't know. I guess I'll throw you this question. Like, is it worth considering putting Towns in the center and trying to find, like, a more viable defensive power forward?
It is, but I don't know,
like, that guy's not on their roster right now.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Maury Moreland Morrison here to tell you Geico has more than just great savings. Much more. Yes, while Geico could help you rack up more moolah faster than you can say metamorphosis, they've also been the fastest growing auto insurer for more than 10 years. That's more like it. Furthermore, Geico has fast and friendly claim service. That might seem like an oxymoron, but it's not. All the more reason to say no other auto insurer has more than Geico. Geico, expect great savings and a whole lot more.
Yeah, and I mean, I've thought about it less since Gordon Hayward has been so good for the Jazz since he's come back, but there was a time where it looked like Gordon Hayward might essentially be someone who you would let go if you're the Jazz, expendable, that's the word I was looking for, and like Gordon Hayward as the power forward.
Even like if we're sticking with Jazz dudes, like Trey Lyles would be great.
Well, Trey Lyles is terrible at defense.
Yeah, but like I don't know, he seems like he at least listens and tries hard. he's just pretty slow. pretty really slow, to be honest.
Yeah, but I get what you're saying. Get like someone who can like defend power forward, someone who's the size of a power forward, so that Karl-Anthony Towns is the center. And the reason why I personally don't like the idea of doing that is because, you know, I really like the free safety concept defensively, having a guy who digs and who gets off of their man and who is the most willing to play team defense, right? And like you can play the power forward and like play that role, right? You know, Aaron Gordon did it a lot last year, although now he's playing the small forward, and that's a garbage show.
Yeah, that's not good news.
But, like, you can do that as a power forward, and that's what I want Karl-Anthony Towns to do, so that you can have a classic rim protector at center. If you're making moves like that as the center, if you're, like, digging when people drive and not just contesting shots, you know, if you're, like, playing like free safety as a center, then you're leaving the rim open and you're not doing
well.
If you're
doing that, you kind of have to be like Kevin Garnett, late career Tim Duncan esque in terms of like ability to read the game and communicate. Like,
oh yeah,
because those guys could play at the center and sort of freelance at the same time, but they were really good at being like, I need you here so I can do this, and knowing when, like, being able to make the choice of when to freelance, when to stay by the rim, like.
What you're talking about is actually what Kevin Garnett did. They would park him on defense when he was on the Timberwolves.
Yeah.
They would park him on defense at like the top of the free throw line, you know, so that he was almost like guarding point guards a lot of the time, or guarding the Kobe's of the world. Whoever like the star was basically was his defensive assignment, but he was put centrally located so that he could affect and disturb and freelance, you know, and you just can't do that as a center. So that's why.
Well, he was playing center for a lot of those stretches, or like in Boston, even. He was playing center a fair amount, and like he was able to freelance and stuff. But I do think that comes with like Kevin Garnett's an incredible communicator and like so smart about knowing what the offense is doing before the offense even knows what the offense is doing. Well, it's unfair to like expect that of anyone.
So the role I'm talking about defensively, though, is the one that KG did it as a power forward. I'm having a hard time remembering who played center for the years that KG was playing power forward. Do you remember?
I know it was Michael Olowokandi for a stretch.
Oh God, Candyman.
Anyways,
you know, like he was playing the power forward defensively, so that there was like a rim protector, even though, you know, whatever. There was like someone playing the center nominally aside him, and that's because he was a younger KG and he could get out. Like KG would play the center in Boston and work as that because he wasn't. I mean, KG in Boston was great, but except in particular situations, didn't regularly use the absurd athleticism that he had.
Right, but
early
that
on
was
his career.
That was what was so impressive about it. Almost is that he was still doing a lot of the freelancing stuff, but it wasn't because he was like, "Oh, I'm KG, I'm fast, athletic enough that I can get from the baseline to the 3-point line in 3 steps." It was.
Well, I think, but I think that that's what James Posey was sort of doing when he was coming off the bench. And, like, Rajon Rondo played a lot of the free safety role defensively. Like, I think that that's...
Right, but, okay, I feel like we're missing the point I'm talking about. Like, it doesn't matter that other people also
did it. Okay.
Like, the fact that other people also did it is sort of irrelevant. The point is that it's it's a doable thing for a senator to do. The question is...
See, I don't think it's a good idea. I don't think it's good.
But he did it in Boston, and they were awesome.
But he didn't do it in Boston.
But he did. But that's not true. Like, he did do it regularly in Boston. Like, that was... There were Sports Illustrated profiles written about how often he would do that stuff. Like, this was a thing that he did. It was just that, like, the way he did it wasn't the same as how he did it in Minnesota. Because the way he did it in Minnesota, like you're saying... Well, it was largely based on, like, a sort of superlative athleticism, as opposed to, like, a sort of game knowledge and awareness sort of tactic, but, which is why it's sort of unfair to expect a man like Carl Anthony Towns, but I don't think that makes it impossible or, like, endemically a bad idea.
Yeah, okay. It's hard to define. We say, like, free safety thing, and, like, that's vague. So, the point is, I understand why Thibodeau wants to groom a center to play along Carl Anthony Towns. Like, because I think that, you know, Carl Anthony Towns is going to be doing what Luol Deng used to do in Chicago for him, right? And he wants someone else to do what Joakim Noah used to do. And I know it's lazy to, like, use player comparisons from coaches earlier in their career, but I do want Carl Anthony Towns to be able to be more aggressive getting out on the perimeter and know that there's someone who's still protecting the rim in a classic sense. And Gorgui fits the profile if he wasn't so bad at doing it, you know?
Right, that's what I'm saying, is, like, at a certain point, though, like...
He could do either.
Like, I think that... You know? I think you're right that, like, the dream scenario for Thibodeau is Carl Towns power forward and finding some sort of rim-protecting pseudo-facilitator in the Noah mold for a center, but...
Like Miles Turner. Like right, that, but, that's Miles Turner 5 years from now is what he would
right.
want, right?
But so how viable? The question is how viable is that as like a gettable thing? Like,
well, the reason why they extended Gorgui Dang is because Gorgui could end up doing this, and that's sort of what I was trying to get to when we initially got into this conversation. Is like the reason I brought up Gorgui is because Gorgui just I thought tonight was like a good demonstration of why Gorgui Dang had so many questions from people going into the season, and like. I was more confident that we would see early signs of, oh, wait, Gorgui Dang just had all these limitations because he was poorly coached. I was hoping that we would see more from him as far as fitting that role because physically, like, his athletic profile and his shot says that he could play the perfect role as the center. But, like, if he's not going to talk and he's not going to, you know, if Tom Thibodeau can't find where the USB port is where he can plug in the Tom Thibodeau defensive center V2 into his head, right? And Gorgui never becomes the player who we're talking about, then, like, they need to figure something else out, you know?
Right. I guess what I mean is, like, I feel like there's not... I mean, we've seen in the season, like, they don't really have a viable contingency plan in place. Like, given their roster, it's not really viable to play Towns at the center because, like, then...
Yeah.
Like, you're playing Bielitsa at the four, I guess. You're playing Shabazz at the four. Like...
Shabazz. That's the answer.
I mean, clearly it's not.
Yeah. So...
It just seems like they don't have, like... They don't have much to experiment with as far as... Like, I mean, there's Adrian Payne, but, like...
Oh, God.
Right?
I can't even joke about Adrian Payne being the answer. I can joke about Shabazz Muhammad being the answer, but... It's not funny to talk about Adrian Payne. You know, and at least they didn't give... I think it was a 4 for $48 was the contract that Dan got. If it was, like, a $16 million... It might have been 4 over $64 I'm going to look it up. Gorgui Dang extension.
Well, meanwhile, on the Charlotte end, I think...
Okay, so it's 4 years, $64 million which is, like, a lot to pay... a guy who you're eventually going to put on the bench. But, like, if... I think this year, what they're going to try to find out is, can we play Gorgui Dang as the starting center in the future Timberwolves? And if not, at least they're not paying him... They're paying him a lot for someone who's coming off the bench, but for your first big coming off the bench. Because he would come off the bench, you know... And play, like, potentially 30 minutes a game, $60 million in the new cap is, like, a reasonable amount. And then they would sign whoever that power forward you're talking about is.
Or, I mean, or if they could find a center to fill it. Like,
yeah, but it's so hard. I mean,
right, that's what I'm saying. Is like,
I understand, like, putting... I understand why this season they didn't find it an alternative. Because Gorgory Dang is someone who I had more confidence than I did by now that Gorgory Dang would figure that out, because I thought more of it had to do with poor coaching than it starting to appear. But now it's starting to appear that it's endemic to Gorgory Dang being a poor communicator.
Right. And that's why I'm sort of hung up on this Townsend center thing, is like, that's just like an, like a, from a roster construction perspective, a much easier get. Like, it's easier to get defensive rim rolling power forward than it is to get solid rim protecting center.
Well,
just like on the market or whatever. There are more Pascal Siakams than there are, like, Kristaps Porzingis's.
Yeah, that's true. But I think that if you have to give up one of them, you give up the jump shot. You know, right? Like, and that's okay. And
yeah, even just like a the fact that Roy Hibbert is a valuable asset right now speaks to, like, the rarity of, like, a really good, solid sort of rim-protecting center.
Yeah, I'm not sure that that Roy... Yeah, but Roy Hibbert, the Pacers... The Defensive Player of the Year candidate, Roy Hibbert, is, I think, someone who Tom Thibodeau would settle for, you know? Like, but that's the defensive game that he's looking for, I think.
Right, no, totally.
And if he can't find someone who has some outside touch, it's okay. They're already number two in the league in defense. I mean, in offense, like, the decreased spacing of having someone who has limited outside touch playing center, like, might knock down their offense so that it's, like, you know, top 10. But, like, if you had DPOY Roy Hibbert on this team, though, they would have the number one offense that we thought that they should have with Thibodeau.
Right, but that's what I'm saying, is that, like, it's easier to find a power forward who can guard power forwards and slide Towns over than it is to keep Towns a power forward and find that kind of center, because that kind of center is, like, a legit asset to any team. Again, I mean, this came up on our last... or not our last one, but a couple episodes ago. This is another great distinction for Willie Cauley-Stein. Like...
Willie Cauley-Stein, yeah.
Yeah, like, Willie Cauley-Stein... I mean, and that actually, I mean, is ideal for many reasons, because he can actually guard both centers.
Although this wouldn't help this team right now. They would be even worse on defense, because, like, Willie Cauley-Stein is not a great communicator and, like, isn't... He's still young, you know?
Right, but he's... you gotta assume he's coachable.
Well, he's a lot younger than Gorgory Dang, and, like... That's the thing, is if Gorgory Dang was going to work, which he still might, I don't know. I wanted to see flashes early, because Gorgory Dang is 26 or 27. Like, Willie Cauley-Stein, if it looks like Gorgory Dang isn't going to work, would maybe be a good investment, because at least Willie Cauley-Stein is, like, 22.
Yeah, and, or like, he might even be younger than, maybe, like, 20 or 21.
Yeah, right. But anyways, we should move along.
Well, really quickly, on the Charlotte end of things, obviously, like we've been saying, Dang didn't have himself a great game, but Kaminsky looked pretty dang good.
Dang good?
Pretty Gorgie dang good. Or maybe not Gorgie dang good, like regular good. And Kemba Walker continues to impress. He had another 30 points tonight.
Yeah.
Batum broke out of a shooting slump, went 4-for-4 from 3, I think, maybe 4-for-5.
Yeah, let me check.
But he had been shooting poorly going into the game.
So Kemba Walker was 12-for-19, and yeah, Batum was 4-for-5 from 3. So yeah, and they were Walker was +20 and Batum was +18.
Yes, yeah, so they were getting production out of their big guns. Like I said, Zeller played a really good sort of not like a box score stuffing game, but like a really good leave it on the floor 50-50 ball screen and roll screens and loose balls kind of game. And they just got, like, this... I mean, we saw it again. Like, Charlotte has a thing that they do.
Yeah.
And they're always going to... Like, Clifford has his team doing their thing every game. Like, whether or not it always works, sure. not exactly true. But, like, it... They do it. Like, they play this... They play this, like, pretty conservative defense and play it very well. They have an offense that moves the ball a little bit and has Kemba as, like, a bailout option. And they've set a lot of good screens, and they play hard on offense. And so, like, I don't know. I don't think we, like, learn anything new about Charlotte, but just that, like, I think that the more I watch them, the more I think that the Charlotte team, again, like, the Raptors probably can't really challenge the Cavaliers, but I think is going to be at least a contender to make the Eastern Conference Finals.
Sure. Mate. Agreed. And if you want to hear more about the Hornets, go listen to my appearance on the Drive and Dish NBA podcast. Shout out those guys. They're great. Yeah, again, that's Drive and Dish NBA podcast. So go subscribe and listen to their last episode with yours truly. I talk a lot about the Hornets. So the next game we're going to talk about, though, is the Bulls versus the Trailblazers. And honestly, this got way out of hand pretty fast. Why don't you start us off?
Yeah, it was a game where, yeah, the Bulls had a 20-point lead, like, before...
Oh, it was 113 to 88 was the end score.
The Bulls had, like, a 20-point lead before, like, I had even, you know, really gotten comfortable in the chair. And it was largely because, I mean, part of it's that they were just, like, bigger and stronger than the Blazers, and part of it's that, like, they acted like they were bigger and stronger than the Blazers. Like, there was very little respect for the Blazers' interior defense. Like, Jimmy Butler and Dwayne Wade, later in the game, Jerry and Grant, were all, like, driving to the teeth of their defense with, like, no reason not to. And no sort of even, like, consideration that there might be a reason not to. And that just, like, let them get a lot of easy shots. And when they missed, Gibson and Rolo were there to clean up the mess. And, I mean, part of it is the Blazers started off just absolutely ice cold. I think, like, 10 minutes into the first quarter, they were shooting 13% from the field or something. Like, they were abysmal early on, but I'm not even sure. Even if they'd shot their averages, I'm not sure it would have made a huge difference because they just could not hang on offense with the, like, with the Bulls on defense. Like, the Bulls were just getting whatever they want on offense on every possession.
Yeah, I mean, and a big part of that is that they're clearly missing Al-Farouq Aminu, who went down last year, or not last year, a couple of games ago, I don't know what injury was.
Well, he was injured, he wasn't there, and that was that was definitely missing, because having a solid physical presence would have definitely helped.
Yeah, and like, it really hurt them that instead of starting him at power forward, the Blazers started Myers Leonard, who, Myers Leonard was really bad. Myers Leonard put up, he was 0 for 6, including 0 for 5 from 3-point land. And he had 2 rebounds and 0 assists, 0 steals, and 1 block.
Right, like, their best bet for this game was to come out shooting and hit a bunch of shots early.
But Myers Leonard not only didn't hit any shots, and literally he hit no shots and didn't have any free throw attempts. He had 0 points.
Right, that's what I'm saying is, like, their dream scenario, right, with this lineup of, like, McCollum, Lillard, Crabbe, Plumlee, and Leonard was go out, spread the floor, hit a bunch of shots early.
Well, they didn't start Crabbe. They played him a lot.
I thought they started Crabbe.
No, they started Lillard, McCollum, Harkless, Plumlee, and Leonard, but...
Man, Harkless was a non-entity this game.
Yeah, 2 for 9.
Whatever starting lineup they had, I think their best bet was to come out firing and hit some threes early and get things going. Instead, they were ice cold, and by the time that they had their offense moving, they were already down 20 points. You know what I mean? Like, there was no way that they were going to be able to, like, contain the Bulls on the defensive end.
Napa know-how. A Napa guy knows more isn't always better, unless we're talking about full-size vans. These beasts do more than get you from A to B. They have so much space a man can live in it. With shag carpeting, waterbed, and a sweet lava lamp, these mobile abodes have all the comforts of home. With quality parts and plenty of Napa know-how, you can keep the original tiny house running longer, stronger. That's Napa know-how. Napa know-how!
So yeah, they knew they were going to need to score points, but there was just a lid on the basket. Like, nothing was falling. And by, you know, like I said, they were down 20 before you could blink. And that it felt like it was just game over in the first quarter.
Yeah, and they really, I mean, their starters particularly, we knew going into this game that their starters were going to struggle. They, last year, by the end of the season, figured out that their starting lineup that was really going to thrive was going to be Harkless, Aminu, Plumlee, CJ McCollum, and Damian Lillard. But, you know, just replacing with Myers Leonard, especially a Myers Leonard who won't hit anything, is really a problem. And plus, Myers Leonard was really getting bullied, too. In the starting lineup, the Bulls, Taj Gibson had 11 rebounds. Jimmy Butler had 12. Robin Lopez had 11. So, like...
I mean, that's 34 rebounds from just those three.
Right, right. You had double-digit rebounds from three different players in the starting lineup. And no... Not one player on the Trailblazers who had double-digit rebounds. Ed Davis got real close with 9. And, I mean... Ed Davis was big for this team. I mean, in a game where Myers Leonard was a minus 21, Plumlee was a minus 17, and Harkless was a minus 26, Ed Davis played a lot of minutes with the starters and was only a minus 6. He had a lot of... His presence just alone made it so that Robin Lopez and Taj Gibson weren't just completely walking all over them.
And, like, every single stop in his career, I've always wondered why Ed Davis doesn't get more minutes.
Like, yeah, well, yeah.
He consistently makes an impact whenever he's on the floor. He's good at finishing around the rim. He's a good rebounder. He's a okay defender.
Well, I would be surprised if he didn't get a shot in the starting lineup now that Aminu's out. But the problem is then, you know, if you're normally starting Plumlee, I mean, the Blazers have, like, the benefit of a lot of depth, but also it's sort of a curse, too, because they finally figured out what their best starting lineup is. But with Aminu out, that key versatility that they had before is gone, and, like, you can't just put in Ed Davis to replace Aminu because, like, you can't have Ed Davis and Plumlee in your starting lineup because the spacing is terrible. And if you have two bigs, you at least want to have good rim protection, and that doesn't allow you good rim protection. Which is like... the Trailblazers have a problem. I mean, I had them like 6th in my power rankings to start the season. But, I mean, if they can withstand some key injuries... because they have so much depth, but, like, Aminu is not one of them. Like, he's sort of the backbone of them having an effective defense because he compensates for so much of Plumlee's lack of rim protection.
And everything.
I can't stand Plumlee. But he also has been, at least in Portland, a great three-point shooter, and, like, they just don't have really anyone to replace Aminu. I mean, if Damian went down, that would be even worse, but, like, the Blazers would be better with CJ out of the lineup. They could at least play crab and get a lot of what CJ did. But with Aminu out, like, they have some real questions in terms of making their starting lineup not be really bad. And, like, I mean, this team, the Blazers tonight lost because their starting lineup lost. Like,
I think that's spot on. But I think, I mean, I also, it's also worth saying, I think the Bulls were a uniquely bad matchup for them minus Aminu.
Yeah.
I think there are other teams they can match a little bit better with and not get run over into the pavement like a, you know, muskrat or something. But this game, you know, you've got big guards and Wade and Butler who can rebound. You've got Rolo and Gibson who are both monsters in the paint. Like, there was so much in the Bulls built to exploit the exact weaknesses that Aminu's absence exposes on the Blazers that... I mean, this, like, they couldn't have... There are a few teams that would be worse for them to play without Aminu than the Bulls.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I agree. And, you know, partially because, like, I mean, Taj Gibson has had a great year, but, like, he shouldn't look as good as a power forward next to, like, against any team, really. And, like, a lot of that had to do with their lack of answer at power forward, which is where Aminu would have played. But also, this game looked even worse because, like, the Trailblazers do at least, they know a lot of this stuff. They know that Plumlee is not really an adequate answer to start at center. They know that they don't really have a starting center. They tried to sign Hassan and I mean, they even tried to sign Powell, which like wouldn't have helped. But they know that they have a problem at the center position. So they went out and they got Festus, who still hasn't played a game yet because he's injured. And they tried to sign other guys, but that didn't work. And the way that they beat teams anyways, or at least the way that they did last year and the way that they hope to this year, is by hitting their shots. And this game, they were 9 for 34, so 26% from 3, and then 35% overall from the field. So, oh, and 61% from the free throw line.
Yeah, I mean...
So the Blazers did not hit anything.
Right, I mean, this was really a worst-case scenario for the Blazers. And it looked like... I mean, the game was... Robin Lopez was jacking up threes in the third quarter. Like, the game was thoroughly out of hand, and it felt like by halftime, everyone on both teams sort of knew the score. You know, it didn't really feel like the Blazers... even the Blazers commentators were kind of talking around, like... There was one part that sticks out where... it wasn't Mike Rice, it was the other guy, I think. Basically said... Well, they're down 18, but if they can hit a three, they'll be within 15, then maybe they'll feel a little bit different. It's like, when you're trying to find motivational levers for the team at the difference between 18 and 15-point leads,
yeah,
like, that speaks to, like, the vibe that they're getting off the team. And the team, the Bulls looked confident as hell, and the Blazers looked shook.
Yeah.
Like, they looked like they didn't think they could hang, and they couldn't.
Yeah, and to be fair... So the Trailblazers' strengths, right, are first that they are good shooting. They're a good shooting team, and they weren't shooting well tonight, so that sucks. And a lot of their weaknesses were put on display because of the particular team that the Bulls are, which is insane, by the way, but let's not talk about that for now. It's insane that they're good, by the way, is what I mean, because
yeah.
No one thought that was going to be a thing, but it is, so that's something that we all have to deal with. Yeah, their main strength, which is their shooting, was not really working out for them tonight. That also screwed up their secondary strength, which is, of course, their guard play between CJ and Damian. But the problem is, if your spacing isn't doing well and you clog the paint with CJ and Damian, that really sucks because they're two small guards and their finishes take up a lot of space on the court. So what I mean is, like, there's a lot of horizontal extension, like CJ will get an arm out and like put some really weird English on it to get the ball in the basket, even if he's being defended by someone who's a lot taller and has a lot longer arms. And you need, like, you know, it's like a gymnastics routine, right? Like, if you don't have enough space to do that because there's Robin Lopez in your way, then like it's not going to work out. It's just going to get blocked, or, you know, you'll just screw it up. So, you know, the strength, their guards weren't really able to do what they normally do and get hot because their spacing wasn't working. So it's like, and by the way, CJ was 7 for 17 and then Damian was 7 for 22, right? So like, the hope is with the Blazers, right, is that if you force everyone to defend out to the three-point line, right, then their guards have enough room that despite their small size, they can get off their shots and hit a high percentage of them. But, like, if your spacing isn't there, then you'll just get shut down in the paint by Robin Lopez or by Taj Gibson, who both of them were contesting shots and not making them look so great.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically... I mean, you know, from the Bulls' perspective, I mean, what's new? Like, they're big and bulky. They rebound a lot. They move the ball okay on offense. Jimmy Butler gets his own shots. Dwayne Wade gets his shots.
And they're both really good.
Yeah. I mean, Jerian Grant, I guess, is the story for the Bulls coming out of this game. That guy had himself a ball game. He had, like, 16 points, 5 steals.
He hit
a couple threes.
Oh, yeah. He started tonight, so... And he, got 18 points.
18 points.
Yeah, 5 steals.
Oof. Yeah, he had himself a ball game. He looked great, and he looked great doing it. And that's big news for them because Rondo's Rondo, and that's, you know, not always a great thing. And
yeah, I mean, this team is going to be a lot better with Jerian Grant starting at point guard.
I mean, if Jerian Grant is really the player we saw tonight, who plays really strong one-on-one defense, who gets steals, who hits threes,
yeah,
who runs the court, then all of a sudden they have a really solid one through five starting lineup.
Oh my god, if Jerian Grant is the player that he looked like tonight, oh god.
Yeah, the Bulls will be very good.
Oh god.
Yeah, the Bulls, you know, I don't know if they're going to be top half of the Eastern Conference good, but they're going to be way more competitive than they would
otherwise. They might be the top half of the Eastern Conference good.
Yeah, they might be. It'll be interesting.
And like, to me, their biggest question mark was always Rondo.
Yeah, well, it was always the point guard position, like, from Rondo on down onto the bench.
And Rondo, by the way, was out tonight with a sprained ankle, so maybe, you know, like, I can see an alternate universe where the Blazers win this game, because Damian Lillard goes off for 45 against Rondo, because Rondo sucks.
Well, that's harsh, but probably true.
But, I mean, like, the team has been actively talking about and, like, throwing shade at Rondo for, like, for blowing all of his defensive rotations, for switching when you're not supposed to switch, and not switching when you are supposed to. Like, I mean, Rondo has been, like, a real problem, and he hasn't been hitting shots for the Bulls. You know, you've seen Isaiah Cannon playing a ton of minutes for them, because, like, at least your defense is going to be the same because Cannon's equally bad at defense than Rondo, but, like, at least you're going to have a little bit of spacing.
Yeah, and I feel like Jerian Grant is, like, a much better fit for what Fred Hoiberg wants that offense to be doing.
Oh, yeah, 3,000%.
As far as, like, pacing and creating space for Butler and Wade to slash.
Yeah. And he was all over the court.
Yeah. I mean, it was great. He was, you know, he was creating lanes for them to slash in, and when they're able to slash with or without the ball, that forces the big men to move up, which opens up space for Lopez and Gibson to work. And it worked. It would just all looked really in sync the whole time, and, you know, that makes them a dangerous team.
Yeah, I can't wait till the next blowout so Robin Lopez can take another three and we can see if there's, in fact, two Lopez twins that can shoot threes. Because, like, Robin Lopez has always hit, like, long twos, you know? And that's part of the reason why they can play Taj Gibson alongside of him, because both of those guys can shoot at least out to the mid-range. But, I mean, if Robin Lopez starts hitting threes,
things are going to start getting weird in Chicago.
Things are already weird in Chicago. That's the Bulls are good, which is weird. So that is it as far as unguarded shooting and the games that we're breaking down for tonight. Lux, thanks for coming on the show. Thanks for talking hoops.
Hey, as you know, every time, all the time.
I think you have a message for our listeners out there.
I do indeed. This episode of the Unguarded Shooting Podcast is brought to you by Steiner Sports. If you're looking for officially licensed merchandise for your favorite NBA team, anything from that Pacers beach towel to a signed Clyde Drexler jersey, the folks at Steiner Sports have got your back. If you let them know that we sent you by using the code ALMIGHTY at checkout, you'll get a 20% off discount on the rare and awesome sports gear you're looking for. I mean, if you listen to this podcast, you're a fan of basketball. And if you're a fan of basketball, you want the jerseys, you want the t-shirts, you want the cool, weird gear. And the easy way to get that is to go on Steiner Sports, use the promo code ALMIGHTY at checkout, and get 20% off. And, you know, get yourself a nice souvenir.
Yeah, they got, you know, signed jerseys, signed, and by the way, not just basketball, you know, for baseball fans, for tennis fans, they've got it all, right? But, you know, you're listening to a basketball podcast, so we can at least assume that you're a fan of basketball. And it's, so signed memorabilia, but also just collectible stuff, you know, like bobbleheads, you know, like, just different merchandise stuff, and
we'll give you 20.
Looking for
just, I don't know, ephemera.
Sure, let's go with ephemera. And yeah, they'll give you that vital 20% off. It might as well be free.
Yeah, and just use the promo code ALMIGHTY at checkout and get yourself a discount and get yourself a jersey.
Definitely. Yep. So thanks for listening to Unguarded Shooting. The day is, well, now it's November 16th, but we just finished breaking down the games on November 15th, and, you know, tune in next time for more breakdowns and more wonderful and insightful stuff from Lux and I. And again, that promo code for SteinerSports.com is
ALMIGHTY, ALMIGHTY. I'm Lux. You can find me on Twitter at MLSurfboard.
And find me on Twitter at Almighty Ballin. And like the Facebook page, almightyballer.com.
And tune in to the Almighty Baller Podcast Network for all kinds of great shows.
Yes. Good night. Or good day. It's good night for us. This is nighttime.
It's good day for you.
Yeah. Well,
because you get a podcast.
Well, they get... they could listen to this at like 2 a.m. when I have this.
But it's a good day for them because they get a podcast.
Yeah. Your day is... Yeah. Okay. All right. Bye.
To understand that I'm more than simply a hype man for this rap group, just like Geico is more than just a company that can save you money. Geico also has fast and friendly claim service, so they can help you when you need it most. And while I do love being a hype man, I also love reading for children's audiobooks. Like Little Bo Peep, she lost a sheep, and she don't know where to find them. Go!
Geico. Expect great savings and a whole lot more.